From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of the world's most renowned musicians, violinist Isaac Stern. Also today, I speak with actress Denitra Vance. She spent a year as a cast member of Saturday Night Live before landing a part in a production of The Colored Museum. Now she's appearing in the upcoming movie Sticky Fingers. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band, the group that combined rock with dry British humor. And John Leonard reviews Quinn's book, the new novel by Pulitzer Prize-winning author William Kennedy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. You know that tired joke? Excuse me, can you tell me how to get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, son, practice. Well, imagine how many times my guest Isaac Stern must have heard that one. He's not only played his violin there about 100 times, but he spearheaded the successful effort to save Carnegie Hall from demolition, and for years he's been the president of Carnegie Hall. Isaac Stern is one of the most acclaimed violinists in the world, but his contributions to the music world go well beyond his musicianship. In addition to his Carnegie Hall work, he was a founding member of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's the chairman and founder of the Jerusalem Music Center. The 1979 documentary about his trip to China, From Mao to Mozart, won an Academy Award. Today he will receive a new award to add to his long list of honors, the 3rd Annual Enhancement of Jewish Life Award of $100,000 from the Raymond and Miriam Klein Foundation. Isaac Stern has recorded for CBS Records for over 40 years, and that's the longest that any artist has been with any label in the history of recording. Before we meet Isaac Stern, let's hear an example of his new record. This is the first movement of Brahms' Concerto for Violin, Cello, and Orchestra. Yo-Yo Ma is the cellist, and Claudio Abbado conducts the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Isaac Stern and Yo-Yo Ma performing the third, by the way, not the first movement, of Brahms' Concerto for Violin, Cello, and Orchestra. And Isaac Stern, welcome to Fresh Air. A pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I apologize to Yo-Yo for cutting him off just at the beginning of the big solo.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, how many Jewish families, how many Jewish parents have said to their children, when you grow up, you should be an Isaac Stern or a Yasha Heifetz or a Yehudi Menuhin. What is it between Jewish musicians and violins? There's been so many. There's this history of Jewish violinists.
It seems to be a history of Jewish violinists. It's a recent one. It only occurred really in great numbers from the late 19th and the early part of the 20th century. There are now a whole other group of young people coming in as well, as you know. There are many, many gifted people from all over, because music has become a kind of passport into authenticity of self for nations, for people, and for individuals. It was an obvious outlet as Jews began to get out of the ghetto and out of the shtetl life in Europe, and as they had been barred from so many normal areas of education, training, and in other endeavors, it turned out that playing an instrument, which was a part, not necessarily the major part of their cultural life, but there was music in their ceremonies, in their happy moments, and the sad moments, and in the official moments, that an instrument which they had a natural affinity for, as have many people, Hungarians, Germans, French, English, many. But for Jews, it was literally a passport.
Well, your parents were Russian immigrants. You grew up in San Francisco?
I got all my training in Russia because we didn't come to San Francisco until I was 10 months old.
Right. Well, did your parents encourage you to play violin as a way to
better yourself? Not at all. We came from that generation of people, of whom we were just one of many, who felt that every child had to be educated. Mm-hmm. There was no question. You had to learn to read, write, and education was a paramount necessity. And the arts were of necessity part of education, not as a social function, not as an acquired social habit, but basically that you were not educated if you didn't know something about the arts. So it was piano or painting or sculpture, but in most cases it was piano to start with, as it was in mine when I was 6. Not as an idea to be a musician, simply to know about music. A couple of years later, when I was 8 years old, a friend of mine living across the street was playing the fiddle. And because he was playing the fiddle, I wanted to play the fiddle. I didn't go home from a concert at the age of 3 and play it from memory. I didn't cry for a fiddle. Matter of fact, I think other people cried when I first took it up. But
I like the way you call it a fiddle, by the way.
Well, let's say it's a familiar. And later, as time developed and I began to get better teaching and came in the hands particularly of a man named Naum Blinder, who was my principal teacher when I was about 12 in San Francisco. And he was my teacher till I was 17. And since then, I've been responsible for my own mistakes.
You know, just last night I was watching the documentary about your trip to China from Mao to Mozart. It's on video now. And there's a very nice moment in which you're telling one of the very young students, you're suggesting to her that she sing the passage that she just played, because she played it very stiffly, or comparatively stiffly. And then she sang it, and she sang it beautifully, and you said you really have to sing the music that you're playing so that you get that kind of naturalness in your sound. Was that advice that one of your teachers gave you?
No, I think it's something that one learns instinctively about music as you go along. I was very lucky because my teacher taught me only what not to do, and he let me learn to learn how to learn, which is very important. It's, I think, the essence of what a good teacher is, that he doesn't make the student so desperately dependent upon him that he or she is unable to think or to find out for themselves. What I try today to instill in any of the young people that I hear, and I hear so many in so many parts of the world, is to get them to use their ears, to hear what they're doing, to understand what the possibilities are. It's a little bit like. Forgive me going on, but you asked a question. You're going to have to run with a train of thought. It's a little bit like what people have asked me many times about a man who influenced me very much in my life later on, when I was 30, in 1950, Pablo Casals, who was an extraordinary musician, an extraordinary human being, a unique human being in a way. And how to explain what Casals was, and this has been a part of my ethic, I think, since I began to think about music. Casals would take you to a wall and open a door and show you the most incredible garden filled with the most exotic, most colorful plants in full bloom with every color imaginable and every cross-pollinization imaginable and full of scent and beauty. And he would show you this garden. Now, how far you walked in that garden, into that garden, was your responsibility. Now, all I can do then for young people is to show them what is possible and make them realize that there is such a thing as beauty, that there are things which exist, and to try to show them how to reach those goals in the simplest form. Good teaching is hard to come by. It always has been in history. It's a little bit even more difficult. It's even more difficult today to some degree. And I think that the practice of teaching the wonderment of music is somewhat lacking today.
Do you take the advice that you give that student in from Malta Mozart, and do you sing passages before you play them?
I think I do that instinctively all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
What does it get you to sing?
Colors, ideas. It's you know, there are a lot of ways to say, you know, I love you. 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 I'm saying the same words. How many times I've said them? The same thing goes with music. Music is literally made up of notes which are simply like a roadmap. It shows you where you begin, it shows you where you have to go in between, and shows you where you're going to finish. It's an outline almost of the cortex of the brain of the composer. You have to divine what made him think of that beginning, how he came from here to there, and where he's going, and why he decided to go that way. The real essence of it, the inside of it, is how do you get from one note to another? Now, that is the entire secret of music making. What is it that makes one note? And it always is the first time. There are never two times that are alike. And that's why music is a constant discovery. There are basic rules. You cannot do that which is not written. You cannot invent or tell the composer what he should have done. It is your obligation to learn what he has done, why he has done it, and then to fill it in with the greatest amount of knowledge and essentially a kind of metaphysical compassion for the wonderment that you can never find the final answer. That's what makes us musicians. There is no finite performance. It is that which makes music what the great English writer, Anand, said. Very great quotes from him. He said, you can describe music, but you can never explain it. And if you can feel touched by that unexplainability yourself and give that sense of, I hesitate to use the word divine guidance, but of a sense of humility and divinity at the same time, then you are just beginning to become a musician.
Violinist Isaac Stern is my guest. When you practice now, how does that compare to the way that you practiced, or what you were developing, what you were working on when you practiced when you were at the beginning of your career, or you know, toward the beginning of your career?
I have no idea. There's no way that I can quantify that statement. I do things today without thinking of how I'm going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that if I tell my head tells my hands, they do it. And if there's a problem, I'll go back and figure out why I cannot, and I will find the proper route for me to go the way I play today. It may not be the way I play yesterday, but that happens all the time. I will rework a work and say, how could I have been so stupid to have done it that way a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, a week ago? I will find each time another way. But I'm looking now, I don't have the physical problem of trying to figure out the physicality, the technical problems of the work. That you do in when you decipher it. That's the beginning. Once that is done, you then work on how to get the utmost out of those black spots on white paper into the ear and head of even one other person listening, whether it's 3,000, 5,000, or one, somebody listening. How do you explain that dot in terms of an idea? That's what you're doing. So what the difference is today that I, through a lot of experience, you learn more quickly how what the problems are. You learn how to achieve certain goals. And then I suppose most of all, your perceptions grow and deepen. You begin to see more and more of what is possible. I think every musician has been sometimes involved in a performance in which he goes, that wasn't too bad. I got close. But that happens rarely. And because you're trying to get there, you know how rare it is for you to get there, and you realize that there are very few performances you honestly can say that all the way.
My guest is violinist Isaac Stern, and I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Violinist Isaac Stern, my guest. Was there a moment in your career where you knew, okay, this is it. I really have become a professional violinist. I don't have to worry about fallback plans. I don't have to worry about playing music I don't want to play or playing, you know, being like third violin in a small symphony, you know, out in a remote part of the country or something. Was there a moment where you knew that you were going to have the kind of career you hoped to?
You've asked four different questions, and each of them deserves an answer. When I grew up in San Francisco, to be a member of the San Francisco Symphony, or later on of the New York Philharmonic, or perhaps others who were, because in my day many people came from abroad, not all members of the orchestra spoke English, to be a member of the Berlin or Vienna Philharmonic, you were a person. You were somebody. You had achieved something. You were a musician. You had achieved personal status and you were someone in town. That is not always the case today, and I'm saddened by that. In my case, there was a point when the first time I played in New York City in Town Hall was not my first Carnegie Hall concert, which was really the start of the national international career, was in 1943. And this was about 1937. When I first came to New York, and I was 16 and 17, I can't remember, it happened before my birthday or after, which is July. And I played, and I was a fair-haired kid out of California, and I'd had some enormous successes just beginning there. I played with my first two great conductors, Pierre Monteux and Otto Klemperer. And given a recital, I came to New York to conquer the big city. And I played the recital. I played very well. And I got reviews, was patted on the head. And then one of them said, oh, yes, from the land of orange juice, sunshine, and movies comes yet another one. You know, things, go home, young man, and practice. And I remember it was a difficult day for me. I was alone in the city with my mother. The rest of the family was in San Francisco. And the rest of that day, I disappeared. In those days, we had double-decker buses in New York. And I remember taking the bus, and I disappeared for about 5 hours. I rode up and down Manhattan trying to figure out what to do because I had been offered before that, at that age already, to be paid what was then an enormous amount of money to be concertmaster of a radio orchestra. They had all the big chains, WOR, WNBC, ABC. They all had orchestras. And I was wondering whether I should become an orchestral musician and earn a living, because I wasn't at that point. I was being helped by the people, and whether I should then begin to support my family and so on. And I said, no. Finally, the end of that day, I went back and said, no, I'm going to keep on playing and trying. I went back to California, where I came back a year later, played another recital, I don't think quite as well. I got absolutely rave reviews, and that started everything off, and from then on it started to mushroom, and after 43 it snowballed. There was never a doubt for me after the age of 12 or 13 that I would be a musician. It never occurred to me to think, do I want to conquer the world? Do I want to earn X thousands of dollars per instant of notes in a given? There was a different time. Today, unfortunately, there are many young people who, after playing 2 or 3 years, want to already have a Guarneri or a Strati instantly available to them, and they're already worried about retirement income plans and orthodontistry for their grandchildren. We didn't think that way. We played, we learned, we made music, and we took life as it came. We worked bloody hard. We cared deeply, and there was a camaraderie.
What are the ways that a musician of your generation got established different from the ways a musician today gets established today? I think you have to win a lot of awards to get.
That doesn't guarantee anything.
I guess it doesn't.
It doesn't, because if you would take the measure of the major competitions that have been in the world in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. and take all the winners from all those competitions, see how many of them are performers today. I would say less than 10%.
Well, I should say that some of today's musicians really got established with your help. Pinchas Zukerman, Shlomo Mintz, Yo-Yo Ma, you've been a great help to all of them. It's obviously something that's been important to you to help out new musicians.
Well, I was conscious years ago of people who helped me, and there's nothing I love more than talent. I love talented children. You know, I tell you, my dear, most kids are talented. It's not always true that their teachers or sometimes their parents aren't able to help them give voice to that talent. But I love to hear young people. I love to see them try. I love to see them achieve. And I can't think of anything that one can leave behind more lasting than younger people that you've touched somewhere along the way.
I bet that a lot of parents and teachers are on your case all the time thinking, well, you've discovered such great talents, you should discover my son or my pupil.
Oh, how right you are, my dear. Everybody thinks that I've got a magic wand, that if I only will take it out and wave it over their heads in their direction, they've got instant career. It's so nonsensical. What I was able to do was to recognize extraordinary talent at a young age that would have reached their goals anyway. I could help and guide it, perhaps, to some degree, to give it voice, to give it enough color and support, and also some ideas of how to develop the talent in each in its own case. I know of no great undiscovered talent after all these years, and I know of no great talent who was not clearly recognized as such early on. The essence of being a performer on the stage, and the final part of it, is not only how you feel and what you know, it's your ability to engender a sense of sympathy and loyalty from a group of people on the other side of the footlights who will be your family of listeners for the rest of your life. You have to have that in order to be on stage. Without that, you can play wonderfully, but it doesn't work. With it, you can sometimes get away with things up to a certain point. But when you put the two together, if you can really play well and you love music and you know what it's about, you can build up an audience over a number of years, then you have what I call a career, a true career.
During your career, you've done many musical things besides playing the violin, and I'm referring here to your work with Carnegie Hall, your work with the National Endowment for the Arts, with several other music organizations. Were you ever concerned about the time that that would take away from playing itself or from practicing? It seems like it takes such undivided attention.
I perhaps would regret it more now than I did then. I think not. I'll tell you, I have an inquisitive mind and a curious soul. And if I were to just stay in a room and practice the fiddle for that sake alone, without realizing how it fitted into the world around me and from where it came and the worlds from which it came, and be cognizant of other things and then become interested in other things, I think I would go mad with intellectual isolation. That's me. I don't say that's for anybody else. So that other activities became, at times, a release mechanism for an amount of energy which I have. At the same time, I had a hidden reserve of my own work that I could always go to for comfort, solace, and strength in music. So they complemented one another rather than take from one another.
You're approaching 70, yes?
I'm 67.
Okay. As you get older, do you feel that you bring more depth to your interpretation of music? From having heard a lot
well,
more
God
experience.
Help me, I hope
more.
So, for mm-hmm. heaven's sake. It's not up to me to say. That's up to you to say. I know you listen to a recording, and you'll hear if you listen to a recording that I've made a year ago to a recordings I've made 20 years ago to recordings I've made 40 years ago, I think I'm trying to. Whether I do or not, whether I'm successful, is up to my listeners. I think that if I didn't think so, if I didn't feel so, I should be the first one to know it and to give up. There is none of us who is who has a successful career who is not the most severe critic of himself or herself. We know exactly what we haven't done and when it is not good, more precisely than any critic will ever know, more precisely even than a colleague will ever know. Because that little lantern in the back of the head that's saying, watch it, what are you doing? Listen, be honest.
We only have a few seconds left, but how do you use that little critic in the back of your head productively and not destructively? Because you can let your own awareness of your own fallibility disable you, you know, or
it can,
or
in some cases,
spur you on.
I don't know. Just everyone has to find his own way of how to put your forces together for your own sake, in the best possible way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the time you spent with us. Thank you for being here, and congratulations to this latest award that you've gotten.
Thank you.
And my guest has been violinist Isaac Stern. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Israeli novelist Amos Oz. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Denitra Vance started out studying classical acting, but ended up playing Juliet of the Slums. That was a few years ago when she was a cast member of Saturday Night Live. She went on to appear in the show The Colored Museum. Coming up, we find out what Denitra Vance is up to now. Only one group could have ever come up with songs like Urban Spaceman or My Pink Half of the Drainpipe. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of Britain's Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band. And John Leonard reviews William Kennedy's new novel, Quinn's Book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Strikes continued in Poland today. Some 7,000 workers at the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk kept operations at a standstill for a second straight day. They are supporting similar work stoppages that began last week throughout Poland. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has details.
Once again, the cheers here inside the closed plant gate are for the illegal Free Trade Union Solidarity and its former leader, Lech Walesa. Just as in 1980, their demands are for official recognition of the union, as well as wage increases. Just as before, there is fear here about how the Polish government will react against the strike. If they use force, like Walesa told the crowd a few moments ago, then it will be like December 1981, when martial law was declared. And where will that get the government, Walesa asked. But unlike 8 years ago, the crowd of strikers is smaller, and the crowd outside the gate is also smaller. There's a sense, despite the urgings of unity, that this strike is unlikely to bring major financial or political gain for the workers, but they have no choice but to try and see what the government does. I'm Bill Buesenberg at the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk.
Opposition spokesman Guillermo Cochez said today Panamanian military leader Manuel Noriega is considering stepping down from power on August 12th. Cochez also quoted President Manuel Solis Palma, saying an agreement on the nation's future may be signed later this week. August 12th is the fifth anniversary of Noriega's accession to power as head of the country's defense forces. The Reagan administration has imposed a government-wide news blackout on the Panamanian issue and had no comment on the latest report. The White House confirmed today that First Lady Nancy Reagan regularly consults an astrologer about the president's activities. But Mr. Reagan says that none of his policy decisions have been guided by the zodiac. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the Reagans are upset about reported excerpts from a new book by former Chief of Staff Donald Regan, which exposed the First Lady's interest in the stars. In the book, Regan claims Mrs. Reagan turned to astrologers to help determine the president's schedule. House Speaker Jim Wright said he's not bothered by the reports of presidential reliance on the zodiac. I'm glad he consults with somebody, Wright said. NBC and CBS have projected Michael Dukakis the winner of the Indiana Democratic primary, with about 3% of the precincts reporting. Dukakis has 73% of the vote. Jackson has 20%. Jackson is expected to do much better in the District of Columbia, where voting ends in about half an hour. The polls have just closed in Ohio, where 159 delegates are at stake. With the Republican nomination decided and the Democratic choice apparent, the primaries have become something of an anticlimax for voters. More from Jim Oddie of Ohio Public Radio.
Despite the perfect weather here, voter turnout in Ohio is described as light. The only area of the state with heavy turnout is in predominantly black precincts in Cleveland. Early on, the Secretary of State, Sherrod Brown, had predicted a 38% turnout. At this point, it looks like he's right on the mark. Democratic voters in Columbus said today there's just not much to get excited about.
I think it's my obligation to vote. I'm not real excited, no. I don't think we have a great selection right now of candidates to choose from.
I think it's the candidates themselves. The system could still be viable with a charismatic candidate, but the ones that are out there just don't seem to generate that much enthusiasm.
Ohio Democrats will award 138 delegates, and on the Republican side, 88 delegates are at stake here. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Oddie in Columbus.
Transportation Secretary Jim Burnley today came to the defense of the 65-mile-per-hour speed limit for rural highways. He said that raising the speed limit to 65 has had no effect on the traffic death rate. Last year, Congress passed a law allowing states to increase lawful driving speeds from 55 to 65. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of a British band whose music had a beat and a sense of humor.
Britannia, Britannia, you are cool. Take a trip. Britons ever, ever, ever shall be hip, 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 hip.
One of the great things MTV is currently doing is introducing unsuspecting American teenagers to British humor. My dad told me years ago that the British never tell jokes on Saturday night so they won't laugh in church. And while that's just a little bit of an exaggeration, there's no doubt that the British funny bone tickles quite differently than ours does. Just check out MTV's Sunday night lineup. First, Monty Python, then The Young Ones, and finally, The Comic Strip, which may just be the most audacious comedy show ever tolerated by a television audience. Of course, this sense of humor has long been a part of the British rock scene, and probably nobody did it better for a longer period of time than the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. Let's meet them, shall we? Hello.
Hi there. Nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums. And Sam Spoons, rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. Come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone. With Roger Ruskin Spear on tenor sax. Hi, Vivian Stanchel, trumpet. Big hello to Big John Wayne, xylophone. And Robert Morley, guitar. Billy Butlin, spoons. And looking very relaxed, Adolf Hitler on vibes. Nice. Princess Anne on sousaphone. Introducing Liberace, clarinet. With Garner Ted Armstrong on vocals.
Well, that's a few of them anyway. The Bonzos started when Roger Spear and Rodney Slater got together in college, naturally, and I'm told that early versions of the band numbered about 30. Most of them were in it for a joke, but around 1965, it turned out that some of the members were serious about making it a band, and they developed a very amusing stage show, complete with robots, mannequins, and various mechanical devices that sort of played music. By 1967, record companies were signing anything that seemed psychedelic, and since nobody could figure out what the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band was doing, they qualified. On their first album, Gorilla, dedicated to Kong, who must have been a nice bloke, they satirized cutesy psychedelic music, lounge pianists, and Elvis, using a tabloid headline for a title.
That night, cutie called a carpool. She left her east side room so drab.
Baby, don't do it.
She went out on the town. No one will make her love from.
Death cat for cutie. Death cat for cutie.
Someone's gonna make you pay your fare.
Seems pretty innocuous now, but it was calculated to get them beaten up by every teddy boy in Britain. Needless to say, anything this silly, being in the grand tradition of the Goon Show and the Carry On movies, attracted the Beatles. Not only did the Bonzos all get parts in Magical Mystery Tour, but they also managed a top 10 single in Britain, produced by the mysterious Apollo C. Vermouth, whom you might be forgiven for mistaking for Paul McCartney, especially when you hear this.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed. I've got everything I need. I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I can fly. I'm a supersonic guy. I don't need pleasure, I don't feel pain. If you were to knock me down, I'd just get up again. I'm all about.
Urban Spaceman never made it over here because of the drug reference, but the album it was on became a cult hit. One track even had a magazine named after it.
One, two, three, kick. everybody, clap your hands. Ooh, you're looking good. Are you having a good time?
Yeah. I sure am.
Do you like soul music?
No.
We'll do the trouser press, baby. One, two, three.
Trouser Press became a big part of their stage act thanks to the fact that Roger Spear learned how to play a rockin' solo on a real trouser press and do it even better than he did on this track. Although the band got more and more famous as American Anglophiles belatedly discovered their poorly distributed records, their third album, Tadpoles, wasn't quite as funny and gave the distinct impression that it was harder work than necessary. In 1969, they released a rock opera, Keensum, and blew into bits. Roger Spear built an all-robot backing band, the Kinetic Wardrobe. Vivian Stanchel became one of those creative eccentrics the British take to their hearts so readily. And Neil Innes wound up working for Monty Python and playing Ron Nasty in the famous Beatles takeoff, The Ruddles. Still, for a moment there, the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band provided a few giggles on the charts. All of them.
Lord Snooty and his pals tap dancing.
And sounding very incisive, the ever-popular Ed Ward on the history of rock and roll. He's the co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. This is Fresh Air. If you saw Denitra Vance in the 1985-86 season of Saturday Night Live, you got a glimpse of the kind of satire about black awareness she first developed in her comedy act. Her own sketches prepared her for the characters she played in The Colored Museum, a satire of black stereotypes. The play originated at the Public Theater in New York and will open at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles on May 5th. Vance is also making her movie debut this month in the new comedy Sticky Fingers. She co-stars with Melanie Mayron, Helen Slater, and Christopher Guest. I asked her how she landed the part.
The part was for either a young Jewish guy or a horny black guy, and they ended up with me. I don't know exactly how.
not close, huh?
No, no. I am all people. I think of myself as every woman and some men.
You started off in the theater, right?
Yes.
Now, how did you get from theater into comedy?
Well, it's funny because I started off wanting to be a playwright. So I thought in order to write better plays, you should study acting. So after I started to study acting, I found that I had a certain amount of talent. And I went away to London to study drama. And I decided I wanted to be a classical actress. And I came back to the United States after getting all my classical training. And they didn't want me to be a classical actress. They couldn't see me as Juliet or Lady Macbeth. So I decided I would write my own material because I couldn't sit around waiting for them to do this perfect American play with me. And that's how it all came about.
What do you remember about the very first night you did your stand-up act?
All I remember, I think my sister took me to a place called Zany's in Chicago. And I just got up on stage and I had something that I thought was funny. And the problem was I didn't want to do comedy just to make people laugh. I wanted to do something that was thought-provoking. And when I got up there, I mean, people were laughing a little bit, but they were mostly trying to figure out what I was doing because it wasn't stand-up. It's more like stand-up theater and not sort of, oh, my wife is so fat, my girlfriend is so dumb. You know, it wasn't that. It was stories based on a narrative. And the reactions were sort of mixed, but it was just scary. All I remember is sort of thinking, no, this is the hardest thing I've ever done, and I don't like it.
Were you doing character comedy?
Yes, I started out doing characters because I'm an actress, so that's what came naturally to me. And being a writer, it made me want to do characters. And I figured, if I wanted to do something with a point. My first character was Jill Brazil, who is 19 years old, and she didn't know that, well, she's, I don't know how old she is now, but she didn't find out that she was black until she was 19. And it's about her life in Kenilworth with a white family, a very wealthy family, and going away to Bennington College to study and then finding out that she was an African princess.
And what happens to her when she finds out she's black?
Well, then she has to be hospitalized. She goes to Bellevue Hospital, where she's in the intensive identity crisis wing.
There were a couple of sketches from Saturday Night Live that I was wondering if they got started as part of your stand-up act, like That Black Girl, which was your send-up of a lot of TV sitcoms, including That Girl, the Marlo Thomas.
One of my favorites.
Yeah. Oh. Did you start working that up when you were doing
Well, in a way,
show?
Because that black girl is very much like Jill Brazil, the one that didn't know that she was black until she was 19. So it's just like very, you know, that kind of, oh, God, you know, life is just a bowl of cherries. I don't understand why I'm having these problems. You know, that kind of a person.
What about Shakespeare in the Slums?
Well, that's definitely mine. I wrote that, and I do that in my show. It's Flotilda Williams is Juliet, and it's like, you know, Basaf, what light through yonder window break? And then I break through the window. You know, so I did that because that was my answer to, oh, so I can't do the classics? I'll do the classics in spite of everything everybody ever says. And that's how that came about, because I have all this classical training and nowhere to use it.
When you got hired for Saturday Night Live, did you feel like you were the kind of like replacement for Eddie Murphy? Do you know what I mean? That you were the black comedian they were hiring?
No, because the funny thing about that, I had talked to a lot of actors who auditioned for Saturday Night Live, black actors and actresses, and they had said, oh, well, we like you, we think you're very talented, but we're not hiring any black people this season.
Oh.
But they did.
Was it hard for you that year? I remember there were some shows where you just didn't seem to be on it very much.
Is that like a question you want me to answer? This is my stock answer. It was the most wonderful, horrible year of my whole life, or the most horrible, wonderful year of my whole life. You know what I mean? It was everything you ever wanted and a lot of the things you never wanted.
Such as?
Well, just it was very difficult because they had, it's the whole thing of being a woman, and, you know, comedy is really for men, isn't it? Oh, of course we have to admit that. And then not only is it for men, it's for either Jewish men or white men or whatever, but it's not for black women. And so to try to fit into a mold, even if they wanted me to be Eddie Murphy, I wouldn't have been, or Garrett Morris, I couldn't have been, because I'm a woman. So it's just so difficult for them to say, oh my goodness, we have to write something for the girls this week. One week they'll write, we have to write for the girls. We haven't written anything for the girls all week. So I thought, well, one Wednesday I'll find out if I'm a girl or not. And they didn't write anything for me that week. They wrote something for the other girls, but nothing for me.
So could you write your own stuff?
I did write my own stuff, but it couldn't be, you know, they have like 16 writers on that show. So you couldn't get your stuff on every single week. Like Juliet, it took me almost the whole season that I was on there to get her on the air. And they already knew that character and liked her a lot.
How did the Saturday Night experience change your career? Did you have more opportunities when you came off of the show?
Well, you know, after Saturday Night Live, we didn't have a clear-cut ending, because over the summer, they were trying to decide what they were going to do, who was going to come back, and they said, Denitra, you're definitely going to be coming back. We just don't know what we're going to do with you. And I thought, what does that mean? They're going to use me less than they used me last year? So we were trying to work that out. In the meantime, I got the Colored Museum. So I've never gone back.
Explain the premise of The Colored Museum.
The Colored Museum is a series of monologues and vignettes, sort of a satirical comedy about black life in America.
One of the sketches in The Colored Museum is a satire of Raisin in the Sun. And it's called One of the Last Mama on the Couch Plays. You're in that, aren't you, in that
yes.
sketch?
Yes.
Would you explain the satire there?
Okay, this is the last mama on the couch play, which is like the last mama on the couch play, because haven't we had enough mama on the couch plays? It's not only Raisin in the Sun, but it's, in my mind, I say it's the Negro ensemble in 15 minutes, because it's all those sort of, son, you know, I'm the mother and I'm the matriarchal of the family and I've taken, and then the son's like, yes, but I'm angry and I want to have a job and I want to be somebody, you know, it's that kind of a play. And then the lady in plaid comes on and she's from Colored Girls, you know, she's that sort of the Ruth from Raising the Sun, but she's also all the Colored Girls from Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Was Enough, all put together. So she's the lady in plaid and she's sort of swirling and twirling and talking to him about liberation. And then I come on and I'm Madea, sort of like the 90s black actress who does all the sort of oh, see how the sun rises in the east. And then, of course, we also do a singing and dancing number a la Bubbling Brown Sugar and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. It's just everything. It's all the sort of black stereotypes from the theater that all put together in one fabulous piece.
Now, back in your theater days, did you have parts in any similar plays, or did you ever play actually in A Raisin in the Sun?
I've never been in A Raisin in the Sun. I must be one of the few black actresses that can say that. I've never been cast in A Raisin in the Sun, but I was the girlfriend in Native Son, so I did get to be killed and everything.
So it seems to me you could really, in a way, even if you wanted to, never get a part in a play like that again.
Probably. Well, the thing is, there are all these young, new writers who are around and who've gone beyond that sort of mama on the couch, the sort of domestic dramas about a kitchen table and about a living room and about oppression and about how hard it is to be black in America. Because that's not over exactly, but there's another slant on it, and that's what George Wolfe has done with the Color Museum. And George is very much of the same mind that I am as far as satirizing.
Was there anything you'd want to tell listeners now who knew you from Saturday Night Live but only knew a part of what you could do because that's all they saw?
I'm bad. I can do all kinds of things. Go see me in my movie. You know, I played a hoe on Miami Vice.
Did you?
I was a gun mall. But I was the guest star gun mall, let me tell you.
Oh, was that fun?
Oh, it was fabulous. I got beat up, and it was very realistic. I laugh whenever I see it. I was sore for a week.
You know, I think of that movie Hollywood Shuffle,
mm-hmm.
and Robert Townsend, and it's saying, you know, that everybody, all the directors would always say, be more black in the role. Did that ever happen to you?
No, because I've always been so black. I don't know. I'm from the South Side of Chicago. You know, somebody did say something about, no, be more yourself, which I thought, that's what I'm doing now. I'm being myself. No, I can't be. No, I mean, talk like that. Oh, I see. But I guess they meant be more black. I didn't get that part either.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Well, I'm so glad you wanted to talk to me. It's been fun.
Denitra Vance can be seen in the new film Sticky Fingers, opening nationally on May 6th. She's also appearing in the play The Colored Museum at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and see what they have planned. Hi, Danny. What's coming up?
Hey, Terry. Well, workers continue to strike in Poland. Lech Wałęsa called today for a perestroika, or restructuring, in Poland, and he said otherwise there could be bloody revolution. Those are his words. We'll talk to a Soviet watcher about how he thinks Gorbachev is reacting to all this. And the Air Force is going to tell us a few more details about that super-secret stealth bomber, the one designed to evade Soviet radar. They say we'll be able to see it with our own eyes soon. And finally, Terry, we'll talk about astrology, the White House, and All Things Considered 17th birthday and what they have to do with each other.
Sounds like a strange brew. Thanks, Danny. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Few modern novelists have mined the history and psyche of a city the way William Kennedy has mined Albany, New York. His trilogy, Legs, Billy Phelan's Greatest Game, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ironweed, was set there, and so is his new novel, Quinn's Book. Book critic John Leonard says the deeper Kennedy goes, the richer the treasure.
Remember, Daniel, says the newspaper editor to the young man who's about to go off and report the American Civil War, the only thing worth fighting for is what is real to the self. Move toward the verification of freedom and avoid gratuitous absolutes. Young Daniel Quinn doesn't know what the editor's talking about, but he'll find out when he returns from a universe of racial dying to an Albany, New York, where a class war goes on, where poor white immigrants are the slaves, and a new alliance of the Irish and the blacks must be raised if a democratic social order will ever come to be. Yes, Albany, New York. We know from previous novels by William Kennedy that in Albany the dead rise up and ghosts talk. But nothing in his earlier books prepares us for the Civil War Albany of Quinn's book. All of our nation's history comes out of its grave, in every ethnic variation, hallucinating, to seize the reader by the throat. There are floods and fire, an iceberg and demented pigs. Drowned women enjoy sex. The beautiful orphan Maud reads minds. Young Quinn, who loves Maud, sees the future in the eyes of madmen, dead whores, and children of the wild river. Black Joshua, a conductor of the Underground Railroad that moves slaves from the South to Canada, hangs 6 feet above the tomb of the outcast and half-breed Amos, half Dutch and half Indian. Rich old men are murdered by owls, and there is hidden in the bottom of a birdcage an ancient magical Celtic disc, a divine riddle, a bloody coin. This is Whitman's America, from the bottom up. Meet John the Brawn, boat captain, professional boxer, saloon keeper, sex fiend, and Magdalena Colon, actress, courtesan, and witch, and Dirk Statz, a conspiracy theorist before his time, which is why his tongue's pulled out, and Will Canaday, editor, abolitionist, and reader of Montaigne. With Quinn, we go to labor riots, or stand by and watch the forced relocation of poor white Irish from Dutch nativist Albany in boxcars, like Indians or Jews. There is no work and no love either, and so they sing lullabies in Gaelic. This Quinn's grown up from 1849 to 1864, full of fatal quizzicality. To what purpose? According to Kennedy, we would call it his will to alter existence, to negate life's caprice, and become causality itself. History has made Quinn into a writer. He believes that words used well can reveal the harmony lurking beneath all the contraries and cacophonies. But history has also made him a warrior. Quote, he would wake up dreaming of his disc and its faces, a savage dream of a new order, faces as old as the dead Celts, forces in the shape of a severed hand and a severed tongue that would bring Quinn great power over life. Quinn's book, part social and moral history of 19th century America, part portrait of the artist as a young man, part epic poem and song of wounds and dream and myth and mystic incantation, is all a dazzle and a wonderment.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Quinn's book by William Kennedy. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with rock singer Rick Springfield. His hit song Jessie's Girl and his starring role on the soap opera General Hospital made him a teen idol. Now Springfield has a new album. It's his first in 3 years. Also, Lloyd Schwartz will review the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra's new recording of Mozart's Serenades. And we'll have a poetry reading from Mark Halliday. So I hope you can join us. And we'd love to hear from you. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.